I'd like to invite the panelists who are going to be part of this session to go ahead and join me on stage and get situated. So, Michael, if you want to come on up. And while you guys are getting organized, I've got a few thoughts to share. As I was organizing my thoughts for this panel last night, it occurred to me that this is probably the most ambitious panel session that I've ever undertaken at the National Ethanol Conference. Not only are we going to be tackling the renewable fuel standard, but also another prominent policy that's impacting the ethanol industry today, the low carbon fuel standard. And we've got quite a variety of stakeholders here with us who are going to be sharing their views. I had a couple of late additions to the panel, which I think really help round out the panel inject some additional viewpoints. So obviously we have a lot of ground to cover, so I'm going to go ahead and dive right in. So I know it's maybe a little bit hard to believe, but we are halfway through the original schedule for both of these programs. So we thought this would be a great time to reflect on the progress to date with these programs, whether they're achieving their goals and policy objectives, what's worked with these programs, what features may need some improvement, and really more importantly, what's the path forward for these two programs that do have so much impact on the ethanol industry today. So I want to start by just sharing a few of our thoughts on the RFS, and certainly this isn't going to surprise anyone after listening to Bob this morning, but we have seen the RFS as a remarkable success to date. And I know this slide's a little bit of an eye burner, but I'm a sucker for a good chart, and so five is even better than one. But I think by any metric that you choose, there is a strong case to be made that the RFS has absolutely lived up to its goals. We have created an industry. The number of ethanol plants producing fuel today has doubled since adoption of the RFS in December of 2007. Production of ethanol has more than doubled in that time. As you heard this morning, we produced a record 14.3 billion gallons last year, which is up from about 6.5 billion gallons the year the RFS was adopted. In terms of economic activity, and particularly in rural areas, we've seen the number of jobs associated with the industry rise by more than 60%. We've seen net farm income grow by more than 60%, nearly 70% in the years since the RFS was adopted. And as Bob mentioned, GDP, the value of our industry's output, has risen dramatically as well. But again, if you go back and remember the original purpose, the main purpose, the major objective of the RFS, it was all about energy security and diversifying the fuel supply. And again, I think we have a remarkable record in moving toward achievement of those goals. The bottom two charts on this slide just show the progress we've made in petroleum import dependence. The red line there has been cut virtually in half since 2007. And obviously, the boom in domestic oil production is a big part of that, but it is inarguable that growth in biofuels have made a major contribution there as well. And that's really what the other chart shows. The share of the gasoline pool that is made up by ethanol has risen from about 4% in 2007 when the program was adopted to roughly 10% today. And then finally, the greenhouse gas emissions goals of the program have seen tremendous progress as well. Ethanol has unquestionably helped reduce GHG emissions from transportation sector over the last 7 years. So, again, it's our position, and this isn't a surprise to anybody, that the RFS has worked exactly as intended in the first 7 years of the program. It has done exactly what was promised. But we all know what happened in 2013 when the 2014 RVOs were proposed, and we just got done hearing about how that process has unfolded, and we know what's happened since then. The uncertainty over the RVOs, the RFS requirements in 2014 and really in the next few years has sent some negative signals to the entire supply chain. Certainly the obligated party, who is, the parties, the refiners, who we're going to hear from later, they're affected by this uncertainty. But it goes far beyond that. The terminal and retail infrastructure development hasn't progressed at the rate that we'd like to see, primarily because of the uncertainty around these programs. Investment in second-generation biofuels, there's a lot of folks sitting on the sidelines waiting to see how the debate and discussion over the 2014 through 2016 rules is going to go before they, before they put a red cent into development of second-generation capacity. Farmers are wondering what, what planning decisions to make. There's a very good chance that we're going to see a huge amount of acreage switch away from corn back to soybeans and other crops this year, partially because of uncertainty around the amount of ethanol that will be required next year. And then automakers, and others. There's a broad cross-section of stakeholders who are affected by this policy, and they all interpret these signals in different ways. So our message to EPA, you heard it from Bob, is to get the program back on track and let that RIN mechanism do what it was intended to do to transform the marketplace. I think we saw evidence that RIN mechanism was functioning exactly as intended, in 2013, really prior to the U-turn on the 2014 rule. Again, we believe EPA has plenty of administrative flexibility to adjust certain RVOs, namely the cellulosic and advanced biofuel standards. But most importantly, I think we have a clear track record now after 7 years that the market will respond to long-term certainty and clear signals coming out of Washington, D.C. So I want to switch just briefly to the California LCFS. Again, this is pretty ambitious to try and take both of these on. But I think it's appropriate, given that later today, the California Air Resources Board is going to be voting on readoption of the low-carbon fuel standard, to go back to, 6 years ago in April 2009, when the program was first adopted, and look at, one of the key statements that was forever burned in my brain at that hearing from the chairman of the California Air Resources Board, Mary Nichols. She said at that time, why don't we just ban all crop-based or all grown fuels and focus exclusively on waste-derived fuels for this program? And obviously, I think that provides some pretty good insight into the philosophy and the ideology we've been fighting for the last 6 years in California related to the LCFS program. When the 2009 regulation was adopted, we were very concerned that, corn ethanol's days were numbered as a viable fuel option in that state because they had assessed, through their life cycle analysis, determined that average Midwest corn ethanol was about 4% worse than gasoline in terms of life cycle emissions because of this land use change penalty that they added on. And they expected that really by 2017, the state would not be using any corn ethanol from the Midwest. Now, in response to that, the folks in this room, the ethanol producers, really flooded the Air Resources Board with petitions saying that 99.4 doesn't represent what we're doing at our facility. We're using less natural gas and electricity than you assumed. And we have these other efficiencies and other technologies that lower our carbon intensity score. And, CARB has approved, something like 200 new pathways for corn ethanol producers. And as a result of that, corn ethanol, grain-based ethanol, has played a tremendous role in the program over the last 4 or 5 years. You see the average carbon intensity of ethanol in the most recent quarter was 81 grams per megajoule. That compares to, about 20% less than what they had originally assumed about corn ethanol, and at the same time, they've raised their carbon intensity of gasoline. Maybe a little bit surprisingly, we've seen more grain ethanol used in California. The last quarter was the highest volume of grain ethanol used in the state since the LCFS program began. And as a result of that, I think there's a strong case to be made that the LCFS has endured so far, or succeeded so far, in large part because of grain-based ethanol. About 60%, three out of every five credits generated in that under the program to date have come from grain-based ethanol. The other thing that's happened in California that's worth talking about is CARB froze the 2014 and 15 greenhouse gas reductions that were in the statute at 2013 levels. So rather than requiring a 2.5% reduction this year in carbon intensity, it's still stuck at the 1%, which has allowed the higher carbon-intense fuels to remain in the game for a while longer. But again, CARB is voting on kind of getting this program back on schedule this afternoon, and the red line is what they're proposing, as opposed to the blue line, which was the original statutory reduction schedule. So, you know, I guess our concern with the LCFS is, you know, things have gotten better. The regulation is slightly improved over where it's been. They are considering a reduction to the land use change penalty today, knocking it from about 30 grams per megajoule down to 20. You know, never mind that the latest work from Department of Energy and Purdue shows that number is probably closer to 7 to 9 grams per megajoule. But what that does is it reduces the average corn grain ethanol carbon intensity value to somewhere around 70 to 75. And that's going to allow corn ethanol to continue to serve in that market as a viable compliance option for a little while longer. But if you look at the graph there below, it shows kind of what the maximum carbon intensity of ethanol can be when blended with 90% CARBOB to, you know, perfectly offset the deficits from RBOB. So if you have ethanol next year that has a carbon intensity score higher than 70, it's going to generate deficits when you blend it, net deficits when you blend it with CARBOB. And it just goes downhill from there. So, you know, obviously the focus of this panel is in our mind, you know, getting the RFS and the LCFS back in gear. Here are the ways that we think that can be achieved. We've already heard quite a bit about the RFS, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time. Obviously, we think EPA really must stick to its statutory authorities regarding how it uses waivers that were written into the law. We've talked a lot about multi-year certainty for the RVOs. I think we're all in agreement. The obligated parties, the renewable fuel producers, even the EPA is in agreement that we need multi-year certainty. The one-year rulemaking process just isn't working too well. Again, we believe EPA and the administration need to allow the RIN mechanism to drive the supply chain investment that's going to be necessary. And I should applaud Mr. Grundler and his staff for the Efficient Producer Pathway Program and the work that they have done on corn kernel fiber. Those are dramatic improvements to the program, and it has been ultimately very successful, I think. But we do still see a need for EPA to return and kind of revisit its life cycle greenhouse gas analysis of first-generation biofuels. In terms of the low-carbon fuel standard, you know, we're simply asking for consistency in how you score different fuels. How you look at the carbon intensity of all fuels needs to be done in a consistent and analytically fair way. And if you're going to include indirect effects for biofuels, you need to consider indirect effects for all fuels under the program and use the best available science and consensus-driven methods to do that. And then finally, I think, you know, there's a need to balance the impact of innovation on carbon intensity with the need for regulatory certainty. We can't have, you know, changes to the baseline gasoline every couple years and changes to all these CI values because it creates uncertainty and investments have been made on these numbers. But at the same time, we want the regulation to keep up with advances in the technology and the latest science. So it is a balancing act, and so far we don't think CARB has done a real good job of maintaining that balance. So that's enough from me. We're going to move on to a very esteemed panel we have today, and I just want to briefly introduce who we have speaking today. First of all, we're going to hear from Jeremy Martin, who is a senior scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, which, as you know, is one of the more influential environmental organizations in D.C. Jeremy's personally been very involved in both of these programs, so looking forward to hearing what he has to say. Then it's going to be Chris Highsmith, who's the director of research at Eco Energy. Eco is one of the leading ethanol marketing companies in the industry, and looking forward to hearing from Chris. Then it's going to be Derek Riegel, who's a senior manager for fuels and regulatory issues for Tesoro. Tesoro is a major oil refiner, particularly in the western United States, impacted by both programs. Then Neil Curler, president, CEO, and co-founder of Pacific Ethanol. As you know, Pacific owns and operates a number of ethanol plants in the western United States, west of the Rockies. So again, deeply involved in both programs we're going to be talking about. And then finally, we're going to hear from Michael Rensing, who works for the BC Ministry of Energy and Mines. And, you know, I think it comes as a bit of a surprise to folks to learn that, you know, British Columbia has had a successful low-carbon fuel program up and operating since 2010, and really been, you know, it's been running without a hitch. And I think it's, you know, what they're doing is similar in ways to California and similar to what Oregon is considering and Washington. But there are some very important distinctions, and I look forward to hearing more about those from Dr. Rensing. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Jeremy Martin.
Great. Thanks very much, and thanks for the opportunity to present some of our thoughts. I was introduced as an environmental NGO. We like to think of ourselves as a science-based NGO, and our group is focused on clean vehicles. And so just a little context, you know, for what we're trying to achieve. So we're working on a plan to cut projected oil use in half over the next 20 years. And to do that, you know, we've run the numbers, and we need to make major strides in efficiency and innovation across all of our uses of oil. And so we've made some great progress. Chris Grondler talked about it earlier on the fuel economy of the cars and trucks on the road. If you think about the 2025 target that we're shooting for to stay on this road to half the oil, we're about 20% of the way there. So solid progress, still work to do. And we can do the same thing in all of the sectors that use oil, the whole transportation sector and elsewhere. And we always need to start with efficiency, because that just there's no way to reach these goals without it, and then that's one of the most important opportunities. But it's not the only thing we need to do. We certainly need innovation. And some of the innovations that we're focused on are the next generation of vehicles, the electric vehicles in particular, the next generation of biofuels, the cellulosic biofuels in particular, and smarter transportation systems, smarter ways of doing business. So when we're talking about cellulosic biofuels, of course, we're talking about the corn stover, the fuels made from various kinds of wastes, and fuels made from environmentally friendly perennial energy crops, things like that. And we've done an assessment of the availability of resources to meet these kinds of aggressive targets, and, you know, how much biomass could we produce in a sustainable way in the United States. And, you know, our biomass assessment is completely consistent with our target of, you know, trying to get 1.7 million barrels a day worth of these next generation biofuels into the marketplace in the next 20 years. That's 40 billion ethanol equivalent gallons. And so these are big numbers, and it's an important part of our plan. But I think it also reflects that, you know, 40 billion gallons is a lot. It's very ambitious. And yet, you know, we need to do all these other things as well. And so, you know, that's one thing that's always important to keep in mind, is it's not an either-or kind of a situation. We need to make progress across the board. So in my remarks today, I'll talk a little bit about the Renewable Fuel Standard and sort of, you know, the thoughts we have about how to move forward in that area. And I'll also talk about my perspective on the Low Carbon Fuel Standard and then wrap it up. So I don't think I need to argue very hard to persuade folks here that the Renewable Fuel Standard's the engine of investment in cellulosic biofuels. You know, without it, we wouldn't have these plants that we have today. I think that's clear. And it worked because it provided this clarity that we were headed in this direction, that this was a marketplace that was going to grow, and that people should put a lot of money on the line to get out ahead of that and position themselves to take advantage of it. And so obviously, right now, the Renewable Fuel Standard is... This engine is stalled, I think it's fair to say. And I, if you, you know, turn on the key and see, you know, I think there's a couple key problems. One, I would say, is the cellulosic shortfall, and the other is the blend wall, of course. And so let me give you my thoughts on those. So this is what the RFS was supposed to look like in this in its last decade, right? The majority of the growth coming from these cellulosic biofuels. But of course, the actual scale-up has been considerably slower than that. And so that doesn't mean we don't need the cellulosic biofuels, but it does mean it's going to take more time than was originally anticipated to get to these kinds of big numbers. And just to put some kind of concrete sense of, you know, how much more time, you know, this says to get there, to get to 36 billion by 2030, we would have to hit a billion gallons of production in 2018 and then 25% annual growth thereafter. And so that is an extremely aggressive path, and that is what it takes to get there by 2030. And so that I put that out there just to clarify that I don't think I'm being too pessimistic to say that the roadmap that's embedded in this RFS regulation is just obsolete at this point. It doesn't reflect a realistic path forward. And, you know, without a kind of sense, without that realistic sense of where these markets are headed, of course, nobody's going to make investment, and we're not going to get the next round of cellulosic biofuel facilities that we need to really achieve these kinds of big ambitions that we have. So the solution's hard but straightforward. We need to update the roadmap, right? We need a more realistic sense of what's possible. And that needs to reflect that the cellulosic biofuel ramp is going to take more time than we had hoped back 7 years ago. And so I think we need targets that reflect that. Somebody asked about the 2016 to 2020 or 2017 to 2022 review. I think that's an opportunity to lay out you know, what's ambitious but realistic, because at this point I think unrealistic targets that are ambitious are not actually helpful at all. I think that that steady but slower growth will actually provide more certainty and support more investment than unrealistic aspirational targets at this point. So a reliable roadmap, I think, is key to getting better outcomes. And so, of course, the other issue is the blend wall, which everybody here is intimately familiar with. You know, there's an argument that we're at the end of the road for ethanol. That's an argument I hear a lot, because we don't have this infrastructure, and so we just need to do something else. And, you know, I don't think that's right. But I think that moving beyond E10 is more like a speed bump than the end of the road or a brick wall or whatever you want to call it. But it does mean that we're going to need to slow down and proceed with caution. So what does that mean more concretely? You know, again, I think it's a matter of, you know, a multi-year plan, an updated roadmap, and I think recognizing that there is some infrastructure that we need to deploy, and that's going to take some time. I think it will take longer than the one-year cycle of, you know, one RFS rulemaking. And so the right question to ask, I think, is, you know, how long will it take? You know, we're going to need this blending to support the continued scale-up of cellulosic biofuels and cellulosic ethanol in particular. But, you know, we really need a roadmap that shows us how we can move towards steady growth and support that investment. But it can't just be the roadmap that one stakeholder wants. It really has to sort of reflect reality and reflect the balanced needs of a lot of key stakeholders, you know, for it to work. And again, you know, I think recognizing that a reliable roadmap is more valuable than a really optimistic one is key here. So let me turn my attention to the low carbon fuel standard briefly. So for a long time, you know, California has been a leader on clean air and clean transportation, and policies that are pioneered in California often make their way to White House and influence the whole world, right? And so here are the automakers lining up to support these fuel economy standards, which have been such a key part of our path to cutting oil use and getting towards clean transportation. And so what happens in California really matters. And so right now we have these four states and provinces working together. And when you add up these members of this Pacific Coast Collaborative, California, Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, by my estimates, this is bigger than France in terms of the economic size of these marketplaces. And I actually used to live in Texas, and I remember a very funny bumper sticker that that I'd see sometimes that said, Texas, it's bigger than France. So I thought, you know, so is the Pacific Coast Collaborative in terms of how important to market it is for, you know, moving forward with clean fuels. But I think it's important to recognize that these clean fuel standards, these low-carbon fuel standards, they're really a turbocharger rather than an engine, right? So the engine of investment in cellulosic biofuels has been the RFS, but these policies can really support that by, first of all, providing an incentive for all fuel producers to reduce their emissions. And, you know, and I think we've seen evidence of that happening with, you know, as Jeff just mentioned, a lot of the emissions reductions coming from more efficient production from existing producers. It also provides additional value for the cleanest fuels, and that's really important when you think about, if you're thinking about producing cellulosic biofuel, I'll let the producers speak, but I think they'd be interested in these markets that are willing to pay a premium for the cleanest, most advanced fuels, and that's really important to getting that technology up to scale and bringing down the costs. And finally, you know, I mean, this is implied by saying it's a turbocharger, but I think these standards work better when they work to complement and support the renewable fuel standard. And so we really need them both to work. It's really not an either-or proposition. So Chris mentioned this last summer. I sense there is often a divide, right, between the kind of the national biofuels picture and the coastal biofuels picture. And so we thought it was really important to help bridge that. And so we organized a trip to Iowa to visit these facilities. And, you know, we brought along some of the folks from UC Davis and UC Berkeley who do the analysis that informs these policies. A couple of folks from Chris's group at EPA, people from the Congressional Research Service, and other NGOs that are important in this space, so that we could really look at what's happening on the ground with the next generation of ethanol. And, you know, lots of exciting things happening, lots of progress being made, and really that's critical to reaching our long-term goals. So I'll wrap it up there. My conclusions, of course, are that we need to cut our projected oil use in half, and we can do it by moving forward effectively, aggressively, with efficiency and innovative clean fuels. That means powering cars with electricity as well as cellulosic biofuels. And to get there, we really need both the RFS and the LCFS and clean fuel standards to work together effectively. And that's going to mean we need a stable and up-to-date roadmap for these policies. And I think it's important to get there. It's easy to say that, but we have to recognize that that's going to be a roadmap for slow and steady progress. That's better than being stalled or having no roadmap at all. So I think flexibility and a long-term focus are key as we work together towards these important goals. So, thanks. Thanks.
All right. Hello, everyone. I'm Chris Highsmith with EcoEnergy. And just jumping right in here, you know, we have some similar messaging that Jeff's already gone over. And next. All right. So this is just a summary slide here showing some of the same stuff that Jeff already has. You know, the successes around the program. It has been a very successful program. Obviously, the two fuels that have benefited most are the kind of low-hanging fruit. These are the technology already existed. The dollars were there, and you see the growth. You know, ethanol more than biodiesel. Essentially with the replacement MTBE, and then you know the Energy Independence Security Act 2007, massive growth in that space. You know, we see it as the program being achieved almost 100%. Obviously, outside of the cellulosic pool. And, you know, congressional intentions are important, and those have not changed. We don't have any new legislation from Congress, and we don't feel that anything has changed there. The, you know, timing of the final rule, as has already been stated, is key from both sides, you know, for producers as far as future investments and business planning and obligated parties from a compliance planning standpoint. There's nothing more important than timing. You know, there's a lot of arguments about where the standard should be set, and, you know, there's a lot of politics involved, but, you know, the the proposed reductions that have been put in place stifle investment in second-generation fuels. One of the things that Chris Grundler said that I really liked, he said, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see how this program was supposed to work. And I think that's pretty clear. You can look at the original mandate and see where things were going. And, it has worked. And, nothing's changed again. But technology development takes time. And more importantly, it takes dollars. And there needs to be some type of regulatory certainty there on both sides. And uncertainty is far worse than known reductions. So when they put the reductions out there, as long as they're timely and the timing of the rules is long-term in structure and, we're not just kicking the can down the road like we have been, I think that there can be still technological innovation and growth in production, as long as that happens. It all comes back to timing, and I'm probably going to say that more than once. So moving on, this just shows the way that the market adjusts. And the gasoline market, petroleum market in general, has a long history of adjusting to regulatory requirements. It goes back to the lead phase out, reformulated gasoline, RFG to RBOB. It wasn't necessarily, the timeline didn't necessarily happen as planned, but it happened. And, reformulated gasoline, it traded up until the very last day that we were supposed to switch over to RBOB on the board. And, this chart above shows blend stocks for oxygenate blending and the growth since the inception of RFS. So this is just how the market has adjusted to having the octane downstream. This is really just economics right here that's driven this. But it's a really good example of how the refining industry can, adapt to changes in the supply chain and adapt to regulatory hurdles. This can continue in other ways. From an RVP standpoint, to allow new fuels beyond E10, we have 1-pound waiver. There's some other hurdles there, but that a lot of that can be done from the base fuel, and the main thing that's needed there is policy certainty, and that really the first person to blink, if that happens to be from the regulatory side, the availability of dollars decreases. And, there's really a ripple effect, that's long-lasting from an investment standpoint in seeing the program through. So, again, this has worked. You see some of the results, not just from the biofuel side, but the way that the refining industry has adjusted, and it can continue to work with policy certainty. Getting a little bit into the LCFS on the next slide here. We think that the LCFS, as originally put out, had some pretty big conflicts with the RFS. California is 10% of the gasoline market in the U.S., give or take, a billion gallons or so. So, the constant changes to that program have hurt. It's been, it's hurt on both sides. Obviously, obligated parties, need to plan long-term for their compliance. There's a lot of frustrations around that. But if California really wants to see the reductions that they've mandated, there needs to be investment. And, those dollars, they don't come without some type of policy certainty. So, where there's been policy uncertainty on the RFS, it's, five times, as much from the LCFS standpoint. And, it's a complex program. I won't go over everything. Jeff really did a good job on touching a lot of that. But, the baseline CI is changing from year to year, from gasoline and diesel. It overcomplicates the compliance approach, trying to model what your needed CI is from year to year, all of the new pathways that come. And a lot of these pathways have been introduced with no steel in the ground, no new investment. These were existing fuels, landfill gas, things like that, go a long way to keep the program solvent. But it hurts producers who have invested early to try to meet the program requirements, and it really sends a solid message to both sides that CARB is going to continually make changes to this program to keep it solvent. CARB has really blinked on the compliance side, and you know, that becomes a very hard environment to invest in. So we would like to see more policy certainty from CARB, certainly, and we would really like to see something that comes a little more in line with the RFS, as far as, you know, where they can run parallel and both programs can be met. So kind of summarizing on the next slide here, we need well-defined targets. You know, the path forward, we have to have timely rulings and well-defined long-term targets. No investment gets done without that. And from the compliance side, if they continue to blink from a regulatory standpoint, the changes that we've seen happen in the marketplace on the lead phase out, reformulated gasoline, some of the major hurdles that, you know, industry said would be, you know, very difficult, we've seen them happen in the past as long as the policy targets remained in place. We'd like to see minimal changes to existing regulations in California as much as possible once they roll something out. But if they're in the process of changing it anyway, we'd like to see them go to a unified policy model where, you know, they set reductions in place that are well defined on the front end. They do not change them. They do not change baseline CIs. There's not remodeling and. You know, there's a lot of regulatory hearings, and it's pretty tough to keep up with a lot of that. And, you know, when you really just, you know, at the end of the day, if the programs conflict with each other, as large as California is and as big of a contribution as it makes to the overall demand in the U.S., it's impossible to meet RFS targets without the LCFS and CARB on board, and those two agencies, CARB and the EPA, working together to try to get a more unified model. So, you know, we do see that changes are coming. We do see that there's going to be a longer term approach potentially taken from the EPA, and we just hope and ask that they work with CARB to try to make that be able to run parallel, so both programs can remain solvent. It's better for everyone involved. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Derek Riegel, and I'm the Senior Manager of Fuels and Regulatory Issues for Tesoro. I have a little anecdote to start with that 3 weeks ago I spoke at the NBB conference, and then now Jeff asked me to come and speak on short notice at this conference. And my colleagues have said, like, geez, Derek, you should have hazardous duty pay being an obligated party. And I said, no, you know what? The issue is, I think that, as you're going to see through my presentation, we're in this, but we're coming at it in a different way. And I think in the conclusion, you'll see that the principles that we hold on fuels policy is very similar to what you all hold. And again, it's that we're coming at it a different way. So first I want to talk a little bit about some of the words I just heard. First I want to congratulate the industry on their record profits last year. I do feel you contribute to the economy by jobs, giving a valued product to the consumer, contributing to greenhouse gas reductions, and I laud you on that. But the words I heard today was a lot of, let's get it right, let's back on track, and I'm going to add, let's have certainty. And one of the things I want to talk about certainty is that this is not an experiment. It is absolutely a change in policy that's going to affect the entire United States and the consumer. And one of our biggest concerns are the consistency and the certainty around the credit markets. And if we don't get it right, the credit market is going to be challenged. I also want to talk about Mr. Grundler, who said that the advanced corn ethanol is going to be needed in the marketplace. And even Jeff said that. And so now I'll get in with the story about who we are. So most of it, I don't know if how many of you know who we are, but I'm going to concentrate not on the history side, but on our growth side. Tesoro's been around since in 68. However, our accelerated growth has been from 2007 to 2012. We announced Tesoro Logistics, which was an MLP. We made a large acquisition of the Carson Refinery in Los Angeles. We announced the purchase of a pipeline, Chevron Pipeline, and now we've even gotten into the natural gas business. As you can see, we're a downstream company, and we do not do upstream exploration. Our key to success is growth. What I want to get, for those of you not familiar with us, our six refineries have a combined throughput capacity of 850,000 barrels. Our marketing segment includes over 2,200 retail sites, which ensures ratable offtake of more than 80% of our gasoline production. What this does is allow our production to be consumed ratably by the retail facilities that we operate. We have a well-developed logistics system, effectively delivers an advantage crude slate and distributes our production. What I want you to pay special attention to in this slide, however, is you see that we market under a number of brands, ARCO, AMPM, ExxonMobil, USA Gasoline. We do have a Tesoro Logistics company, but the most important thing I want to bring to your attention is where our greatest volume refineries are, which are in Anacortes, Washington, Martinez, California, and the Los Angeles refinery. So we are the largest refiner on the West Coast, four refineries in three states that have LCFS, which is really unique to the petroleum industry. Not only do we have RFS, but we're also constrained by LCFS. Constrained may not be the right word, but we have to operate in an environment that wants to have an LCFS program, and we have to find to viably work there. We also operate in a state where the proposal is to reduce consumption by 50% by 2030. On top of that, we operate within a cap and trade system within California. But as you can see from the slide, we chose to operate in the West. And we've made significant investments in the West Coast, just now investing, it was announced Tuesday, $300 million in our Anacortes refinery for mixed xylenes. But you have to understand, we are working in an environment that is extensively regulated and requires us to be environmentally compliant. So now what I'd like to talk to you about is, knowing that we work there, knowing where we are, and then now we're working in a world of only the national RFS, LCFS, what is our position on fuels policy? And I'd like you to pay special attention to this and the fact that the words we use are similar to the words you use. We're just coming at it in a different way. We're looking at a competitive free market operating on a level playing field with a clear, stable, and well-designed legal, fiscal, and regulatory framework that will best serve the broad interests of consumers, suppliers, investors, local communities with respect to economic prosperity and energy security and environmental protection. I would give to you that is similar to the goals that you all have. On the point of free market, energy policy should allow consumer choice and free market to determine the mix of required energy sources and drive the selection of solutions. This one gives me a little bit of heartburn. I don't necessarily know that how we can, you all or the renewable industry, can get a product into the market that the consumer can demand if the infrastructure is not there. It's a chicken or the egg thing. How do you get it there? Question becomes, who funds it? Does the petroleum industry fund it? Is it funded by some kind of tax advantage or some type of grants? I'll leave. Sound science. Regulations should adopt a system approach addressing vehicle, fuel, and infrastructure issues. Again, everything you want. Environmental impact should be done on a wells-to-wheels basis, involving carbon intensity calculations, on a complete life cycle basis, and includes both direct and indirect land use. I know, Jeff, I just read your comment to the ARB. Yes, there's an ARB board meeting today. The ethanol industry is looking for an adjustment in ILUC. Fine. What does that, though, also tell us? Uncertainty. It's very difficult for us to be working in our environment on the West Coast that has LCFS and RFS. We're going to need low CI fuels, and as it was demonstrated, the time is going to run out for corn ethanol to be used for us for compliance. Appropriate cost-benefit considerations. A rigorous cost-benefit analysis should clearly demonstrate the benefits to society exceed overall costs. Interactions with our regulatory program should be fully considered, recognize the value of sound risk assessment, and challenge and monetizing environmental health benefits. Again, to this note, is the biggest problem or the biggest challenge we see are the credit issues. As we go through, and I was just on the advisory panel for the state of Oregon, we look at the curve for LCFS compliance, and we will be working in a credit-generating mode for the first half of the curve and then be exhausting those credits in the second half of the curve. Now, the question becomes, what dynamic is going to have to occur within the industry for us to purchase a higher cost product to build credits at a time where in other areas we don't have to do that because we're not working in a low carbon fuels domain? It will come to a point where when the credits that are surplus should be being used for exhaustion or compliance with the rest of the low carbon fuel standard in the years out, there's going to be a real pinch point there. It's who really built the credits and are they going to be available? Finally, clear and reasonable regulatory framework. To ensure a level playing field, all regulated parties, new regulatory programs should have the following attributes: clear and unambiguous regulatory language and minimum complexity. I think that Bob, you, and the rest of the group can go along with this, even in the fact that the debate over the waiver authority. There's been quite a bit of debate on the EPA's waiver authority on the 2014 numbers. We're coming at it in a different direction, but what we want is regulatory certainty. And adequate time and certainty for implementation, including planning, permitting, and construction for startup. Feasible compliance pathways that allow for optimization in producing and distributing fuels. Avoid adaptation of infeasible regulations or regulations requiring creations of new technologies in order for them to be feasible. So what we're looking at there is saying, look, you know, what is truly the feasibility of these second generation fuels? And are we forcing technology to get there? And are they going to be available? And is the program that we've put in place, LCFS or RFS, going to be feasible if they don't? Flexibility to adjust program requirements in response to developments in science, economic impacts, or unforeseen consequences. It sure would be nice if we could build off-ramps into these regulations, particularly in LCFS, should something unforeseen occur. And an appropriate structure for compliance and enforcement. And I think you can know where we're going there when we just went through the biodiesel issues. So in conclusion, I'd just like to offer that we do have similar approaches to these regulations and have sincere passion on getting it right. We chose to operate in the environment that in the West Coast with the most radical or constraining environmental impacts, and it behooves us to get them right. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to offer some perspective from a producer standpoint, and I really appreciate Derek's comments and, frankly, everyone's comments. And we do all share the same goals to make these programs work and make the environment better off and the consumers better off for what these policies can definitely result in. So Pacific Ethanol, we have four ethanol plants in the western United States, so we do have a unique perspective certainly on the low-carbon fuel standard and the renewable fuel standard. Our plants are among the lowest-rated carbon ethanol plants in the United States, and we have two plants in California. We market for the other two plants in California, and those four plants producing over 200 million gallons of ethanol at a CI score of 80.7 and all of them working on pathways to reduce those numbers have been a very significant part of compliance under the program. Certainly the energy security economic development benefits of all of these programs is clear. Jeff did a very good job of outlining the results. I think it's very important. Certainly California Low Carbon Fuel Standard and a key element of the RFS is greenhouse gas emission reductions. And just to remind everybody, the problem is quite real. I think sometimes even us in the industry don't take this seriously enough on how significant the GHG issue is. You can see it in the graphs in terms of the concentration of CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions in the environment. And we see it in the heat we experience every year, getting warmer. And it's also very important, I think we don't do enough to promote the fact that ethanol and biofuels generally are the most significant thing we can do as to displace and supplement petroleum products to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And transportation being 28% of U.S. and in California 36% of the greenhouse gas emissions are from transportation. And also with the increasing miles traveled and consumption, it's been closer to half of all the net increases in greenhouse gas emissions since 1990. Corn ethanol on a direct basis reduces and getting better every year, 40 to 50% displacing gasoline for greenhouse gas reductions. And it's the most important thing that we have done in this country to lower our greenhouse gas emissions in transportation is the use of corn ethanol. So you can all be very proud of that. We've done it with an industry that's grown very quickly, done it very efficiently, lowered costs to consumers. And the going gets a little tougher as we see some of the ambitious goals to bring on the new technologies, the low carbon fuel standards, increasing requirements, the RFS. And the only way we get that done is through pricing carbon. And we need to do it in a way that's it's certain, it's predictable, it can generate the investments, because that's what it's going to take is new investments. It ultimately will not only help us deal with the most intractable environmental problem, namely climate change, but will also allow us to continue to drive automobiles and to grow the economy and do it in a way that's sustainable. But it doesn't happen without some very clear, coherent policies that are represented by the RFS and the LCFS. And these are policies that have worked. I won't spend too much time on this. I think Jeff did a great job of showing the results in terms of the growth of biofuel production, the reduction in carbon that we've seen in California. And we have achieved tremendous results. And the challenges certainly get more difficult, but we also need to recognize the progress to date. And in terms of the RFS and LCFS, these are truly, as you've heard from others, very complementary programs. I see the RFS as really being the workhorse, a national program that has set the bar, and the LCFS in California and British Columbia now being adopted in Oregon and Washington. And, you know, we believe we'll see adopted elsewhere in this country and in other countries as well, that it really layers on and provides a very complementary program to achieve even greater results. A lot of the value of ethanol, I mean, we already had an infrastructure even before the RFS that allowed the 10% blends. We've seen it grow into full penetration. The RFS has been significant, but really it's the octane advantages and the price advantages of ethanol that have really made this program so successful. And as we move forward, it will continue to be the price and the octane that will continue to drive it, but with certainly a need for the new technologies that will become more expensive, and that's where the pricing of the carbon is something that has to be addressed. In California, we've seen the fuel mix. It's you know, compare and contrast. In the RFS program, it's a liquid fuel program. In California, it's more technology agnostic, electricity. We're seeing renewable natural gas be a significant part of it. We've seen a lot of renewable diesel. So corn ethanol has been the workhorse of that program, but we've also seen a diversification and an increase of other fuels, and that's important, and it's going to be very necessary to that continue to be the case. The program has absolutely generated innovation in the existing ethanol industry. You can see that in the carbon intensities that continue to drop and will continue to drop in the future if we have coherent strategies. So what's wrong? Why are we stuck in neutral? You've heard quite a bit about that already. It is the lack of certainty and the lack of market access. I mean, we're at 10% ethanol. It was good to hear Chris Grundler refer to the blend wall as the so-called blend wall, because we really do believe there is no blend wall. This is an issue of getting the infrastructures in place, and it's the economics are there. We need to have clear signals that say we need to move beyond the 10%. They do 27%, you know, starting this next month in Brazil from 25. They do 20% in Thailand. They're going to 15% in Argentina. I mean, we're seeing it all over the world, and we're actually are lagging the rest of the world in terms of taking the same cars that are produced all over the world and the same distribution networks, and we just need to get on with it and move into those higher-level blends, which are going to be critical to achieve the results. And we need to get the science right. We've heard that indirect land use is an issue. We now know in retrospect, when you look at real world data, that what was projected did not, in fact, happen. It does create a lot of uncertainty, both as producers and marketers. We need to focus on that which we can understand and that which we can control, and those are the direct impacts on a life cycle basis. And what you can see from these graphs is what the uncertainty has created is a lack of price signal, a lack of the kind of carbon pricing that is going to be required to drive the innovation and move these programs forward. We've seen it with the CARB blinked, and appropriately so, because there were some mid-course corrections that were needed in that program. But we saw the pricing of metric tons go from $80 to $20 overnight. At $20, I can tell you, it's a nice tip for the low-carbon ethanol that we produce, but it's not sufficient to drive the kind of innovation that we as a producer are prepared to make, whether it's bolt-on cellulose ethanol plants, greenfield, whether it's anaerobic digesters, combined heat and power from biomass. These are all things that we can do to lower our CI by 15, 20, 25, or even more points, which will make this program successful. But there has to be an incentive to do that. We've seen the same in the federal program with all of the uncertainty on knowing that there's going to be a market for the more expensive advanced biofuels. The RIN pricing between the D5 and D6 has collapsed to nothing. And while it's great to see the plants that are producing today, we're not seeing a lot of new investment today until we get this figured out. This was a chart from the California Resources Board in their recent analysis of the program that's being discussed today in California to reauthorize the LCFS to show what the power of pricing can do. So a corn ethanol at 70 or a cellulosic ethanol at 20, you can see at elevated prices, $50 to the proposed cap of 200, you get out to 200, a dollar a gallon on cellulose ethanol, on top of an incentive at the federal level. That's the kind of price signal that will, in fact, generate investment and will generate the production of these fuels. And I will say, at a cost to the consumer, that still is quite reasonable. It sounds like a lot on a dollar a gallon, but that's it's 10 cents when that's a 10% blend on the gasoline at $200 a ton. If it got to that, we don't think that it needs to get to that cap level. That would be about 20 cents a gallon of gas in California to make this program successful. So what do we need to do from here? We need clear messaging on the benefits of biofuels. I think that's really incumbent upon everybody in this room, is to really articulate the value that we bring to the economy, to the environment, and to our energy security, octane, price to the consumer, all of these things that we all know well but don't really read enough about in the paper. So I think that to really stand behind our product, to make it be a part and a very rapidly growing part of our future needs, we have to be the messengers of why that makes so much sense. And we need the EPA to maintain the integrity of the RFS. We need the Congress to not create the uncertainty by talking about repealing the RFS. This is a program that works, and implemented properly and with the discretion that the EPA has, we can make it a very, very successful program and drive the kind of results and innovation that the program calls for. I mentioned the LCFS. We absolutely need to calibrate that program. We're making comments today in California on this, and I know from a refiner's perspective, they want to see the certainty on this as well. And we think that California should, you'll hear what they do in British Columbia. We've seen what Oregon has proposed, and it doesn't include indirect land use. This is not something that, not only is it not ready for prime time in terms of our understanding, it, again, is not something that we can build a business case around because of the lack of clarity and uncertainty. We should focus on direct impacts. The indirects we need to deal with directly as well. We need policies to make sure that we don't deforest the world, and countries like Brazil are showing that that can be done. In California, and this is back to the being mutually supportive programs, we need a change in the regulatory framework in California to allow higher level blends. Right now, all of the gasoline in California is produced using what's called the predictive model, and that predictive model has a cap of 10% ethanol. From a refiner's perspective, they want the flexibility. They don't necessarily want to be blending that E15 now, but as compliance moves out in the future, we should give them the optionality under that model in California to be using higher volumes of these lower and getting lower carbon fuels. Otherwise, the program will not work. We need more than 10% ethanol in the gasoline in California by 2020, absolutely, probably after 2017, to make the program successful and give us the certainty that we need. And we need to expand these programs. We need to see Oregon and Washington fully implement their programs. I think the regional LCFS market overlaying the national RFS will show that we have a very robust, vibrant, integrated program that is absolutely going to generate the new investment in the lower carbon fuels and make both the LCFS and the RFS a very successful programs with achievable targets. Thank you.
Jeff assures me that I can ignore the time clock here. I'm listening to some of this discussion, and I have often mentioned that I'm going to have a T-shirt printed, and I think now the front is going to say, relax, it's only complexity. And the back is going to say, no, it's more complex than that. Low-carbon fuels is complex legislation, but it is also complex science or complex understanding. And all the talk about ILUC and even the direct life cycle analysis of fuels is a pretty clear example of where that complexity stems from. So you must appreciate that as regulators, our job is to take a very complex, possibly even chaotic, body of information and turn it into the simplest possible black and white rules that can be applied. And it's a tough job. I sympathize with people who only have a staff of 15 or 30 in the case of CARB to deal with this. I have 3 vacancies. Anybody want a job? Because I've got no staff today. So I'll give you a quick overview of the low-carbon standard as it is in BC, and I just want to say it's not moving forward. It is the green button, yes. There it is. Now I moved too far. So in British Columbia, we have legislation that is both an RFS and an LCFS in the same piece of legislation. For the purpose of this discussion, I'll say it's very similar to California, but it's more complex than that because we differ in many ways. We have a requirement for 5% renewable content in gasoline, 4% renewable content in diesel, and the same carbon intensity reduction schedule for California, 10% reduction by 2020. It has not been smooth sailing. We've not had the same kind of legal challenges that both CARB and the EPA have had, but that's because we're in a very different regulatory and legal environment. We have definitely had to put our regulation on hold for several years, and in fact, the first time we required a legislated reduction in carbon intensity was starting July 1st, 2013. If you want certainty, I'm telling you, indirect land use change is coming everywhere. Don't make the assumption that it isn't coming, but for BC anyway, we were not directed to include it, as California was, so we're waiting for the science to catch up. Number of questions. Everybody's aware of the issues, but I'll add one more, which is when you say all fuels, what about the petroleum industry? Because if the value of a low-carbon fuel is the difference between the regulatory level required for the year and the value of your fuel, that regulatory limit is set based on the petroleum numbers. And in BC anyway, if we started including indirect land use change for all fuels and there's a significant ILUC factor for petroleum, our baseline will go up and it's the delta that will matter. So if ILUC applies and there's a similar shift, maybe there's no impact on compliance rules. It's too early to tell. This is a complex slide, and I won't leave it up for too long because it'll twist your eyes, but all of the means of reducing carbon intensity in transportation are meant to be recognized under the low-carbon fuel. So the curves you're seeing includes a wedge for biodiesel, a wedge for renewable diesel, ethanol, natural gas, compressed natural gas, and liquefied natural gas. Electricity, and we already recognize the carbon intensity reductions from light rail and tethered mobile trolley buses, electric buses operating in Vancouver. And we have one mechanism that California doesn't have, where we enter into agreements with companies to provide extra incentives, and we award credits under what we call Part 3 agreements. But given all that diversity, strong action in one area means that a reluctant stakeholder can take less action in another area. And so we forecast success, of course, but we really are leaving this to the market to decide and to find paths to compliance. Some of the market then chooses to see that we will relax because they weren't told what to do. So we have performance-based regulations, we think, and the opportunities are so diverse that we find that actually when industry wants performance-based regulation, they're not as serious as you would hope sometimes. This is the credit calculation or debit, and it's very similar to California in that the main generator of a credit or a debit is two factors: the difference between the carbon intensity of the target and the carbon intensity of your fuel, and the amount of fuel sold. So you can get a large effect from a large amount of fuel with a small carbon intensity reduction, or a small amount of fuel with a large carbon intensity reduction. And that's where the values of lower carbon come in, either because of these so-called blend walls, or because you don't want to handle as much fuel. What could that look like? Well, this is a chart that I've used for a little while. This is carbon intensities for British Columbia. Think California minus 30 grams in general. We are using a different model. Bob Don O'Connor appreciates your kudos that if it's done by Don O'Connor and GH Genius, it's done right. So do we in BC. The worst fuel on that chart is on the far left, palm-based renewable diesel. It's a renewable fuel, but it is 2.5 to 3 times worse than petroleum products. And in BC, our petroleum products are 60% oil sands-based. We're trained not to use the words tar because they're our neighbors and we have to get along. Corn ethanol is about 55 grams. That's the first of the beneficial fuels. 1,000 liters, about 250 gallons, generates half a ton of credits. But we have approved a carbon intensity for a grain-based ethanol that is minus 4.23 grams. I'll talk about that a little bit later. We've got the renewable diesels and even the biodiesels from waste or canola coming in even as low as 10 grams. They can get lower, but that's real product that's registered with us. The volumes are low. But 1,000 liters of good quality, low carbon biodiesel will generate 2.5 tons of compliance. 1,000 liters of corn ethanol generates a half ton. And I think that is the picture, that as the regulation gets more rigorous, the higher carbon intensities get less desirable. But we're not forbidding any fuels. You could supply that palm-based HDRD if you want to. You're just going to have to offset it with a heck of a lot of credits. How's the market responded? Growing Power, a company in Alberta, has integrated their ethanol production with a feedlot. So they don't do wet dry grains, they do wet grains. Across the fence, actually I think it's just across the road, to the cattle feedlot. All the waste from both operations goes into a biodigester. The methane that results powers the ethanol plant, as well as a cogeneration plant that turns on the lights and, when they're in a surplus situation, feeds into the Alberta electricity grid, which is coal-fired electricity. So it's an offset credit. It adds up to the net benefits being minus 4 grams. They're doing offsets in that model. Husky Energy has been manufacturing ethanol in Canada for 25 years. They've just implemented carbon capture and storage. It's reduced their carbon intensity by 34 grams per megajoule. There is a CO2 sequestration pipeline system being built in Alberta, and they're tying into that. The irony is that gas is used for enhanced oil recovery. but it is a significant reduction in the carbon intensity of the ethanol, and it's a retrofit to the old plant from 25 years of production. Imperium Renewables Biodiesel in Northern Washington has made energy efficiency improvements, upgraded their plant over the last couple of years, keeping in mind that they were already a fairly new plant, and are generating other products and just registered a improvement in their carbon intensity of 18 grams. They're down in that 10 gram per megajoule range now. And then there are other fuels. So when we talk about the low carbon fuel standard, we go beyond the liquid fuel pool, of course. Natural gas can reduce carbon intensity by 30%. Electricity has low carbon intensity, but there aren't enough electric vehicles yet in the market to make a difference. There are pulp operations in BC that have a need for chemicals, and hydrogen is a waste byproduct from their operations. And BC is a bit of a hub in hydrogen fuel cell development, so we are actually expecting to see some of the first vehicles available for retail sale coming to the BC market for hydrogen. And every one of them is dealing with the issues that the renewable industry is still dealing with in general sense. Infrastructure, market acceptance, high costs, the petroleum suppliers who have to buy those credits to get into compliance because the standard measures everything. And so if you're selling high carbon products, which is really just petroleum, you're going to have to get your credits from all of these sources. And that credit market is really critical to the functioning of a low-carbon standard as opposed to an RFS because it functions like the RINs, but it stretches across much wider range of energy sources, and it has a lot less clarity in how it can change the market right now because it's an evolving market. That market also needs to evolve to value each fuel. In BC, I've heard that we have suppliers who are not yet ready to negotiate a fuel price for renewable based on the carbon intensity of the product. They're still in a mindset with the RFS concept that we didn't say what kind of renewable it had to be, so all ethanol should be the same price. And as the low carbon requirement gets more rigorous, the market is going to start paying for the benefits of low carbon. And yeah, we need to have long-term stability. Our answer in BC has been that the science gets updated through the life cycle assessment model every year sometimes, but we're approving our numbers and living with the consequences for up to 3 years. So in another 2 years, I hope that we aren't being challenged because we're recognizing an obsolete number for somebody when really the mechanism was to provide that stability to find a place in the market. But it would be an unwise supplier who thinks that that is a permanent approval and doesn't anticipate what the new science tells them at the end of an approval period, because when you come into the new approval number, the new approval dates, you're going to have to deal with the current science. So we'll go on into the other parts of our discussion. Thank you.